Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This morning will be filled with music from Craftsbury and Côte d'Ivoire. Yes, the Ivory Coast. We'll meet a former Vermont gubernatorial candidate who just finished high school this year, and we'll also get tips on how to finally quit smoking. But let's open this week with some beautiful music. You never quite know where in Vermont you'll find amazing talent. Now, when I think of Craftsbury, I think of great Nordic skiers or even some aging pitching talent in the form of Bill Spaceman Lee. But chamber players? Well, the Craftsbury Chamber Players have a long esteemed history and have some great performances for you to hear yet this summer. Joining me to tell us about it is Francis Rowell, the music director and one of the cellists for the Craftsbury Chamber Players. Fran, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for asking me to talk to you.
Oh, absolutely. Listeners, to ask Fran Rowell about the Players or to share a performance of theirs, maybe even one of their earliest, you can call us and tell us about it. 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Fran, take us back to 1966. What and who got the Craftsbury Chamber Players started?
The Craftsbury Chamber Players began as four musicians who were invited by a summer resident of Greensboro to come to Greensboro for the summer and make some music for people that missed having concert experiences while they were here, which at that point was very often a three-month stay. We're well past those days when anybody has that kind of time. But they set up 4 weeks of concerts the very first year. The suitable place to play turned out to be the dining hall at Sterling School in Craftsbury, hence the name Craftsbury Chamber Players.
Oh, my gosh.
That's where they started.
Oh, I love it.
Yep. So they did this for 4 years and would bring in some guests after the first season. And then the Hardwick Townhouse was sitting down there in Hardwick, and people started looking at that and going, this would be a great place to play. And they organized a 30-year lease on that building in 1970. And local people got involved in the preservation of the building and utilizing the building better, and it became the summer home of the Craftsbury Chamber Players with some of the best acoustics anywhere.
Mm.
Anywhere. It's a beautiful, beautiful place to hear a concert. And so in 2000, the lease was up, and various other folks have stepped in and various organizations to really develop what the hall can be, and there's the Northeast Kingdom organization that's running it now and doing a fantastic job of continuing to update it. So it's been our home since 1970, and we're still there.
Oh, that's incredible. But that's not the only place you play. Where else is home to the Craftsbury Chamber Players?
In the middle of the 80s, a group of patrons in Burlington really wanted to bring the ensemble there and worked very hard and still do to this day. Some of the same members are part of this committee that facilitates our appearing in the Burlington area. So we began doing pairs of concerts. We play one in Burlington on Wednesday nights in the Burlington area. It can vary where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And then we play the Thursday night traditional Hardwick concert. At this point, we are at the Ellie Long Center for four of the Burlington concerts, and we'll be playing the final two of this season at First Baptist Church in downtown Burlington.
Wow. So what is the mission of the Players?
You know, the mission is quite unchanged. It's just to bring chamber music into the mix of the very rich life of this area. I mean, there's a lot of music going on. In the 60s, this was the music that wasn't here.
Yeah.
In the meantime, there's more chamber music available than there ever has been in Vermont. But we're just a part of the mix, and we're the only thing happening up here in the 60s. I have to say that COVID, in my mind, has cemented our mission.
Mm-hmm.
When we started, I was planning the 2020 season in March just as everything shut down in 2020. And at that point, you know, we had the 14-day quarantines to do anything.
Right.
You know, and I'm looking at my July summer and realizing there's no way this is going to happen. So we hedged and realized that we were going to have to cancel the season. And when it got to be June and restrictions were easing up a little bit, I started thinking that maybe we could do some outside playing. So my sister Mary was here, and all we needed to play a very, very deep, rich group of pieces was a pianist who would join us. And that person was Mary Jane Austin from Montpelier, who was in the same boat we were, you know, idle.
Right.
And she was very, very glad to step in and play some programs. So I started thinking about what music we could play, and we came up with a couple of programs using the piano trio. And then I have some colleagues that are in my work life in the New Jersey Symphony, have a property up here, and they were up here. And they're both violinists, and my sister Mary can also play the viola. So we put together a string quartet program. So I had 3 one-hour concerts that I could do with people who were here. And the only problem was we needed a safe place to do it, and the answer to that is outdoors.
Right.
And we all know that these instruments do not like being outdoors. They don't project well outdoors. They need to be in a shell of some kind. And, boy, do they not like the elements. When the dew point starts happening, literally a violin becomes a slick.
Mm.
I mean, so we needed some kind of shelter to play in. And the most sensible answer to me was a trailer with a tent on it and some baffles. So I told my brother Dave, who you know.
Dave Rowell, yep.
Dave Rowell, that I wanted to borrow his utility trailer and do this. And instead of rolling his eyes, he said yes.
Wow.
And so I was all set to manufacture this mess on this trailer that we could pop up and play a concert on. And I'm in my house in East Craftsbury, and I hear the most horrible screeching sound coming down the road that kind of rings the house. I couldn't imagine what this was, so I go to the window, and here is my brother Dave with his Tundra truck with this wreck of a frame with some wheels hauling it down the road. He went to a neighbor who he knew had a trailer that he had once used to haul his crawler around, and he knew this thing was up in his woods. So Dave went up, talked to him, and made arrangements to buy this shell or frame, and he just took a logging chain, wrapped it around his hitch, wrapped it around the trailer, and dragged it home.
Oh, my goodness.
So we set to it, and with the help of Ron Jeffrey over in East Hill Auto, we got this thing roadworthy, got some new hemlock boards as a floor on the thing, and we By mid-July,
yeah,
it was ready to go, and we started playing concerts. And we would announce a concert on the internet, little phone tree,
yeah,
and we would just show up when the weather was good. And we started by doing a little teaser in the parking lot of the Craftsbury General Store just to see if everything worked. Then we said we would be playing a Friday night concert on Craftsbury Common, and we had 250 people.
Oh, my gosh. Music was saved.
Ugh. Outdoors, safe. You know, nobody had everybody's mask. It was great. And at that point, I realized we were fulfilling what the mission is to take music to people, get the music to people.
Oh, Dave Rowell gets a great pat on the back. How about that?
Yeah, oh, kudos to Dave.
No kidding.
Yep, and he didn't roll his eyes is the part that I was grateful for. But we did 22 concerts, all of them announced within days when we would check the weather, say, oh, it looks good, and we were invited to Plainfield by a woman who organized us using the ball field. The Waterbury Church invited us to come play, and we did, I think, 2 or 3 there. We did a concert at the Bread and Puppet Theater.
Mm-hmm.
For that one, there's no power in their field, so we ran 2 cars down with an inverter running the PA system, but we got out of there.
Incredible.
We jump-started our way home. And then we went down to Lincoln because folks there invited us to come and organize the space. And all we had to do was have somebody show us where to go, and we'd play a concert. And all we did is put a bread box out on a chair, and we broke even.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. What?
Arts.
People came out. People were as generous as they could be. Yeah. You know, you didn't have to put anything in there, but people did. And last year, we still couldn't go fully indoor, so we kind of split the season into three indoor, three outdoor. And at that point, I could get folks in here because we could travel again cautiously. And we still weren't going to sell tickets because the whole thing could collapse at the drop of a hat.
Right.
So this is the first year back with schedule, indoor concerts, and everything's...
All right, we're going to get to that. Let's take a break. And as we go to the break, I'm speaking with Fran Rowell, of the Craftsbury Chamber Players. We're going to listen to Beethoven's Sonata in C Major from the Players. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. We're hearing Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, performed by the Craftsbury Chamber Players. It's been 56 years that the Players have been delighting audiences in Vermont, and they still have a number of performances for you to enjoy this summer, including two this week. Fran Rowell is with me discussing the Craftsbury Chamber Players, and if you'd like to ask her a question or share a comment, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Fran, the musicians that make up the Chamber Players, they're incredible. Where do they come from? How do you get them to be part of this group?
We have a wonderful group that have been coming for a very long time. Anchoring it is Catherine Mary and I have been involved in some form or other since teenagers, including ushering at the concerts when we were young students. And then as we became professionals, being able to come home to play music, being invited to do that. Marc Antonio Baroni, who you just heard playing the Mussorgsky, comes from Philadelphia every summer and has for 20-plus years. Kenji Bunch is both violist and composer. We just played a piece of his here, 20-plus years. Catherine Winterstein, 20-plus years. Monica Hucci. Carol Rodland. This is a group of people that have been coming since young professional adulthood to play, and we keep bringing new friends. That's how we expand our list. We make some music with somebody and would call Mary Anthony when she was the music director, Mary Anthony Cox, or now me, and say, you got to call this person. Let's get them up here. This is fun. So that's how we find our players. There's just a deep connection and a thread that weaves us all together. And people really like to come, which is very nice, too.
Yeah. What are some of the highlights of this year's season?
First concert, we just played a piece by Kenji Bunch that was based on some Baroque dances, French Baroque dances. And because of who was coming, we were able to surround this with Renaissance music and contemporary folk music, which was a great thing to hear grouped together. Last week, we played the Grieg String Quartet for the first time ever here.
Hmm.
You realize that I have a database.
I know.
We played.
I love this.
900 different pieces of music since 1966 this group has played.
When you go to the website, which is CrasburyChamberPlayers.org, you can see every piece that the players have ever played and when they played it.
I have to update it, but, yeah, there's 3 years not there yet.
Oh, okay. Okay, almost every piece. Sorry, Fran.
Yep.
Oh, I think that's phenomenal.
It's great. And coming up, we have, like, this week, there's three pieces. Two have been done before, but not in a while, because Mary Anthony Cox instituted the seven-year rule. We do not perform something again unless it's been at least 7 years.
Gotcha.
It just keeps us from being lazy.
But
we're doing a piece in the middle between these two huge, wonderful, lush pieces, the Prokofiev First Violin Sonata and the Mendelssohn Second Piano Trio. The cellist, our guest cellist this week, Robert Burkhart, and I are going to play something nobody's ever heard by the cellist who was in Haydn's orchestra at the Esterházy court and basically was one of the inspirations for him writing his wonderful second cello concerto. But this guy wrote this parlor piece to play in his own concerts, and it's a riot. It's just a cello orgy. We're having a ball.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just silly. And then next week is a concert that's pretty unusual because it's Italian instrumental music, classical instrumental music. And, I mean, what we know is of Italian classical music is opera.
Right.
But there was this other tradition, and so we're playing the chamber music.
Hmm.
Our concert, August 10th and 11th, the fifth concert, is very, very deeply classical. Every now and then I look at what I've programmed and realize that there's no Haydn or Mozart on anything, and there should be. So we're covering that this summer well. And the last concert is something we've been waiting to do since 2020, and that's celebrate Beethoven's birthday. His 250th birthday was interrupted by a pandemic, and if that isn't ironic, what is?
That's right.
Oh, my goodness.
What will people learn, Fran, at the pre-concert chats that you have?
We talk about what we're going to be playing that night, but the floor is open. And if somebody has a burning question, you know, we'll go down that tangent, too. You know, it's just a chance to chat, really chat, not a talk.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that you do that is very special is the afternoon kids concerts. So what do you play for them?
They're unusual concerts in that we do not play children's music. The format for these concerts is the same one that I heard when I was 7 and 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
What the players do is take excerpts from the evening concert and just contextualize it for a child and then play the music and just let them hear it. Don't explain it, just let them hear it. And, you know, I remember doing this. They even would come around with a borrowed van and pick kids up to take them to hear it in the early days. It was wonderful. You know, you could get there. And there's a tradition that we loved, which is the last piece of every CCP kiddie show, the kids are invited to come sit among the ensemble. Just come up and get on the floor, park yourself at the feet of the cellist, stand behind the violinist, whatever, and get to just be part of the band.
It's
really cool.
You mentioned how the players come back year after year for a couple of decades. And what is it that you and they enjoy so much about being part of the Crasbury Chamber Players?
It's many layered, actually. First of all, this place. It's a beautiful place to be. There's just summer pleasures of swimming and biking and running and just being out of a major area. There's this audience that comes, which is a mixture of quite sophisticated people who are subscribers to all kinds of classical music things and people who this is the only chance they get to hear it. And they're, you know, in the audience together, and it's great. You know, They're just mixing. And then there's the, what we get to play. I mean, when you, you know very well when you succeed at something, you kind of get pushed into doing that. And you get kind of limited to that. Imagine a drywaller who's the best mudder ever, smooth. That's what he does, and he's in demand because he does the best job, the fastest, and so forth. But the dream is to make furniture, and that's what happens night and weekends, but not making a living at it. Our version of that is playing Broadway, playing freelance symphonic things, and running around and doing this. And to be able to just stop all that, sit down with wonderful musicians and colleagues and play chamber music is amazing.
We've got a minute left. You do have these wonderful musicians. How is the group funded?
We have a very wonderful group of donors and supporters who just every fall after the season, we appealed for next year and offer them the opportunity to buy some tickets without knowing what's coming, and they do, and they donate. And we have been able to keep ourselves, we're very fiscally responsible, and we've been able to keep ourselves viable. And we're incredibly grateful for the support.
56 years. It is absolutely wonderful. Frances Rowell is the music director and a cellist for the Craftsbury Chamber Players. They're performing at Ellie Long Music Hall in Colchester on Wednesday and at the Hardwick Townhouse on Thursday. And to learn more about their performances, you can visit craftsburychamberplayers.org. Fran, I want to thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me, and have a wonderful day today.
All right, you too. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll return to find out what happens after you run for governor when you're 14. And tonight, Tito and the Guardians invade Fenway Park. Our coverage begins at 6:10, first toss at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Back in 2018, Governor Phil Scott was running for re-election for the first time. On the Democratic side, the primary included Christine Hallquist, James Ellers, Brenda Siegel, and a high school freshman from Bristol named Ethan Sonneborn. Christine Hallquist won the primary, and Governor Scott won re-election. But Ethan Sonneborn won quite a few admirers and believers in that race, garnering almost 4,700 votes. Ethan just graduated from Mount Abraham Union High School and will be starting college in the fall. He joins us now to share what that 2018 campaign season was like for him and what his plans are for the future. Ethan Sonneborn, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. I'm glad to be here.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Ethan a question or share a comment, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ethan, you were actually 13 when you first entered the race for governor, a freshman at Mount Abe. What were you thinking? What motivated you to do this?
Well, you know, anytime you ask a politician this question, you'll get, you know, this answer that it was probably a lot of things. For me, though, what it all really boils down to is that I think that this is an incredible state, and I think that in a state as great as ours, we can be doing so much more for so many more people, right? I was looking around in 2018, and I saw that across the country, and maybe even especially in Vermont, there were so many people that despite how we brand ourselves as progressive and how we talk about all these things we care about, there were so many people falling through the cracks and sort of being left behind by government, and that's something I wanted to address because as a young person, I also know what it feels like to be sort of left out of the debate.
What was the reaction of your parents when you told them that you wanted to do this?
Well, they were supportive, if a bit skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always these practical questions, and then also the legal questions, like whether or not I was even eligible. But once we figured out how the campaign was going to work, we figured out that I was an eligible candidate, then it was smooth sailing from there.
And they had no qualms, knowing that this would mean driving you around the state, which would be a lot more than just driving you to, say, trombone lessons.
Yeah, it was a lot of driving. But I think my parents understood the importance of public service, and they, I think, were happy to sort of help my campaign in that way.
And then you show up at Mount Abe after you announce your candidacy. And what did the students, you know, your fellow students think, your teachers, what was the reaction you got there?
You know, it's obviously an unusual thing. So the reactions were almost all positive, but many of them were a little bewildered, maybe. It's a little hard to sort of wrap your – it's a little hard for me even now to wrap my head around.
Right.
So my classmates were supportive, but, you know, I'm not sure they or I really totally processed what it meant that I was running for governor until, you know, maybe a few weeks or months in even.
Now, you had to get your name on the ballot. That was the first hurdle after you realized that you were indeed legally allowed to become a candidate. This required, I think, 500 signatures of registered voters,
Yep, that's right.
Which you were not a registered voter. How easy or hard was that, convincing people, could you sign my petition? I'm running for governor.
So petitioning is an interesting thing. Initially you hear 500 and you think that doesn't sound like that much.
Right.
That, you know, you can sort of, you break down how many people you know in your head and you think, really, I only need to find, you know, I probably know 100 people, 200 people, and then I can, that takes out a big chunk of it. But once you get out there and you start trying to collect petition signatures, it can be tricky because, the petitioning process, in my experience, was not widely understood. People thought that by signing my petition, they were committing to vote for me or endorsing me in some way, which is not the case. And so when you get out there and you start petitioning, you have to explain about petitioning, and you have to explain, you had to explain further, in my case, why I was running and if I was eligible, right, if this petition signature was a waste. And so petitioning ended up being more difficult than I had anticipated, but ultimately we did get the signatures we needed, and got on the ballot.
Well done. Now, how does a high school freshman create a platform while he still has to finish his algebra homework and turn in a term paper?
So balancing school and the campaign was certainly something I, took seriously. We, you know, I had to do my best at both things, which could be challenging at times, especially when there were scheduling conflicts, when there were things for the campaign that I needed to do during the school day or things for school that I needed to do outside of school hours. But really, my teachers understood, I think, the importance of what I was doing, and it really, I think maybe even, I think campaigning enriched me as much or more than school would have.
How was your GPA that spring semester, you know, in 2018? Did it stay up? Did it go up, go down?
Well, it was a fine GPA. I'm sure I could have, you know, I may have wanted it to be better, but I'm not sure that the reason it wasn't was because of the campaign.
Ah, okay. You were just goofing off as a freshman. Now, Ethan, did you have any kind of a group of political advisors who helped with, you know, coming up with a platform, with coming up with campaign strategy?
Yes. I had a small group of my friends who were all my age, helped on my campaign, and they were very helpful. They sort of helped me plan how I was going to campaign, where I was going to campaign. They helped me, you know, draft remarks for events, et cetera, et cetera. And then beyond them, I had some more informal advisors, people who maybe with more political experience who I would talk to sort of not in any official capacity, but just to get their advice or their input.
Now, statewide campaigns have gotten very costly. They take money. Did you have to do some fundraising to keep your campaign afloat?
Yes. I feel pretty lucky that we did not – we decided early on that we were not going to be a campaign to spend all of our time fundraising, right? So traditionally in campaigns, you have the candidate do a lot of what we call call time, which is basically just you get a list of people you think might donate to you, and then you call down the list and ask everyone on the list for money. I didn't do that because I don't believe that politicians should be spending more time funding their campaigns than running their campaigns. So instead of doing call time, I opted to, you know, get out to every event I could, talk to every voter I could. But yes, campaigns do take money. That's true. And
how much did you
raise? A lot of it.
How much did you raise?
By far the least of any of my opponents.
Do you remember how much you raised?
I don't, off the top of my head. No.
What were your biggest expenses during the campaign?
So lawn signs are a big expense.
Right.
Other merchandise is less expensive. Buttons, stickers are fairly inexpensive. On the final weeks of the campaign, we launched some digital advertising, which was maybe the biggest expense of the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But really, we you know, we stretched the small amount of money we had, and I think we used it pretty effectively and efficiently. One of the things that inspired me to run was feeling like there is too much money in politics, that, you know, special interests and big donors sort of have an outsized influence on the outcomes of elections. And that's one of the things I wanted to sort of push back against in my campaign.
Ethan, what kind of campaigning were you able to do with having to attend school and, you know, not having a driver's license?
Well, luckily, because of the timing of the Vermont primary, the campaign really starts to heat up in the summer,
right,
which was sort of a happy coincidence for me. While school was going on, I did campaign. I tried to schedule events around school instead of scheduling school around events. So I was mostly successful with a couple of exceptions. I almost exclusively campaigned outside of school hours so I could continue to focus on school, but once you get into the summer, that's when things really escalate. You start doing, you know, multiple events a day. You really don't have many days where you don't have an event, because that's when everyone starts to want to hear from the candidates and sort of narrow down who they're going to vote for. So the calendar sort of worked in my favor on that.
Yeah, good point. Do you remember your first forum or debate when you were on stage with the other candidates? How nervous were you, and how did you do?
I don't remember my first one specifically. There were a lot of them. I wouldn't say I was nervous. No, I believed then, and I believe now, very strongly in everything I said during my campaign. You know, I am supremely confident that the issues I talked about, the ideas I laid out, were the right issues to talk about and the right ideas to lay out. And so, you know, I can't really speak to how I did, because I was there and I'm probably a little too close to that situation to objectively analyze it. But I didn't feel nervous, and I feel good about my performance in all the events I went to, because I was talking about, you know, real issues that matter to real people.
Did you ever question your decision, maybe thinking you took on a bit more than you could handle?
Question, maybe, but regret, no.
Yeah.
I think, you know, sort of by the nature of campaigns, you're subjected to, even as a as a 13 or 14-year-old, you're subjected to a lot of criticism, and that's fair. That's valid. People should criticize their politicians. But it was also, though, such, I think, an important and rewarding experience getting to talk to so many people, to hear their concerns, that, you know, whenever I would question it, my doubts would be erased by the next campaign event I was at, where people would talk to me about their struggles with affordability or jobs or education.
What was it like on election night as the results start to come in?
So we had a fairly small campaign party, an event, and so my campaign team and I sort of huddled around some computers. We pulled up the results on a big screen, and then we sort of just wait. Election nights are obviously nerve-wracking,
yeah,
even if you know that you're a huge underdog, like I did. And so the results start to come in, and you pay attention to what you're looking for. You pay attention to the benchmarks you've laid out, what numbers you want to be at and what places. And then ultimately, things wind down. And in my case, I called Christine Hallquist to concede. But election night is, you know, sort of the culmination of a lot of things. It's a culmination of a lot of hard work, both hard work carried out by yourself and hard work carried out by others for you. So election nights are, even though essentially the die has been cast, they're an important part of the campaign.
As I mentioned, you got 4,700 votes. What did you think of the results? Were you disappointed, proud?
I wasn't disappointed. Well, obviously, I wanted to win. I wish I had won. I think I'm most proud of being able to talk about ideas that no one else wanted to talk about, to take stances that no one else would, and to sort of lead in that way, to sort of shape the dynamic, shape the debate. And so I think in that sense, it almost didn't matter what the results were, because the point of the campaign was not my own personal career advancement. The point of the campaign was to make a real difference for ordinary Vermonters. So I wouldn't say I was disappointed, no.
Had you won, had you beaten the field in the Democratic primary, had you gone on to beat the incumbent governor, Phil Scott, how would you have balanced school and being the governor of the state of Vermont?
That's a question I got a lot during my campaign, and the honest answer is that I'm not entirely sure. I think there are options. It would certainly not be a traditional high school experience for me, right? Going to a physical high school from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. probably wouldn't have worked if I were the governor. So we never laid out a clear plan. We never identified exactly how it would work. It probably would have looked something like a form of, you know, professional tutoring in the times when I wasn't governing. So while I don't know specifically, I was confident then and still think probably it would have been an issue that wouldn't have been all that difficult to work out.
You're on to American U in Washington studying poli-sci. I can't wait for the first time you're sitting in one of your classes and you raise your hand and say, well, when I ran for governor, what do you hope to do once you graduate from American U?
Well, I don't know exactly yet, but I know I'm still committed to public service. I know I still care about people who are being forgotten, people who are being ignored. So while I don't know exactly what my dream job is, I do know that I want to keep fighting for everyone to have a fair shot, everyone to have equal access to the things that make Vermont great, the things that make the United States great. So I guess my answer is essentially what I want to do after I graduate is go wherever I can do the most good.
Ethan, we've got a minute left. What do you think you learned from going through this entire process?
I think the most important thing I learned is that sometimes you find yourself in challenging times. And in 2018, I believed, and I still believe, that this is a moment that demands more of us than what we would have traditionally thought. You know, what I learned is that the crises we face, the challenges that we are encountering in the last decade or so, and perhaps even more, they are truly generational. And what everyone, I hope, would learn, that I learned, that I hope I maybe helped some other people learn, is that you absolutely must do everything you can when faced with such important moral and political questions.
Will you ever run again? Will we see your name on a ballot again? Yes or no?
Well, that's a ways down the road. So I am committed to doing whatever I can to do the most good. And if someday in the future that looks like running for office again, then maybe.
Ethan Sonneborn of Bristol was a candidate for governor of Vermont when he was a freshman in high school. Now he's about to be a freshman poli-sci major at American U. Ethan, thanks for being on the show. Best of luck in your future endeavors.
Thank you, Rick. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. We're going to take a break for CBS News, then we'll return to talk about getting off the smokes. And coming up this morning at 11, it's Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Quitting any habit or addiction is hard. Giving up smoking has got to be about the most difficult. Logical appeals to friends and loved ones never seem to gain much traction. Time to call in the professionals, a couple 802 Quits partners. Joining me now to discuss the help that's available to smokers considering quitting is Sarah Cosgrove. Sarah, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And we also have Dana Bourne. Dana, great to have you here as well.
Thank you so much, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Dana and Sarah about quitting, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sarah, what is 802 Quits?
802 Quits is a great service that's available through the state of Vermont. And we have phone counseling that is available, and that is a great resource. When someone calls 1-800-QUIT-NOW, they're actually patched through to these cessation services. And through participating with an identified counselor that you would get through that, they work through the skills with you to help build up that, you know, self-confidence, and that you have a plan in place that you can really take that first step towards quitting. Another great piece of this is that through participation with 1-800-QUIT-NOW, you get free nicotine replacement, which is very, very helpful. I call it like the Band-Aid that really takes care of all those cravings that a person usually slips back into, you know, smoking or vaping again. This nicotine replacement in the form of gum, patches, or lozenges really helps take away that painful piece of quitting to work on the counseling piece that you're working with through the phone.
I love that you mentioned 1-800. Yeah, that you mentioned when you call 1-800-QUIT-NOW, you're patched through. Dana, you said it, not me. Dana, what exactly is the role of 802 Quits Partners?
So 802 Quits Partners is really kind of our way of connecting Vermonters to Vermonters who can help them quit. So as Sarah said, 802 Quits is really this great resource to be connected to on the phone or on the web to these great coaches who can kind of help give you the skills you need and are necessary for accessing NRT, which is a nicotine replacement, and kind of learning those skills to help you quit. But our quit partners are really Vermonters all over the state who are trained in how to support quitting and how to support other individuals in that cessation. So I like to think of our quit partners as really a way of Vermonters helping Vermonters and really connecting each other and providing that support services.
How long have you been doing this, Dana?
So I work for the state of Vermont, so I kind of oversee the 802 quits aspect of things. So I've been doing this for about 2 years, and Sarah is a lovely quit partner that
yes,
we have
she
who
is.
Has been doing this for quite a while. I'll let her brag about how long she's been doing this.
Good.
So this is Sarah. I'm a respiratory therapist who, you know, caring for people that were already had smoking-related diseases, I wanted to be more preventative. So I really took the initiative to be trained as a tobacco treatment specialist. And I've been doing this for close to 16 years now.
Wow. Yeah, and I was a big fan of yours. I don't know if they still run the TV spots with you and one of your partners.
With Rose.
Yeah, with Rose. That's right.
I still have people that will come up to me and they'll be like, how is Rose?
Yeah.
She is a lovely soul. Yes.
I'm like a fanboy about that. Well, Sarah.
Oh, I think.
How does someone looking to quit acquire that quit partner?
So all our local hospitals here in the state of Vermont are connected to the cessation resources. And it's through My Healthy Vermont to get that face-to-face or the virtual local piece of quitting. And I have to say, like as Dana was saying, that local touch adds a huge piece of it. When you know it's someone right here in your community and that they care about the community, it adds another layer to it. You know where to find them. You can look in their face. You know that they're there to help you. So My Healthy Vermont is a great place to start to find out what classes are available. But also by calling the 1-800-QUIT-NOW or reaching out to 802QUITS.org, you can be connected to those resources in your community.
Dana, what percentage of those trying to quit, even with a partner, quit for good the first time?
That's a really good question. So I think, you know, we like to think, oh, I'm making a quit attempt, so I'm going to be successful. Well, we actually know that it takes on average about 11 quit attempts for someone to successfully quit.
Wow.
So we like to feel like every time someone is accessing 802 quits or accessing a local Vermont quit partner, you know, they're learning the skills they need for that next quit that's going to be more successful and helping them along the way. So while we know it's not, you know, for most people, it's not that first time that they're accessing quitting support that they're going to be successful, we find that each time they're trying to quit, they're learning more and more about themselves and about their habit and about how they really need to address quitting the next time. So I would say on average, it's probably not pretty high, the number of people who quit on that first try, but the next, you know, the future tries are more successful because everyone's been able to learn about what they need moving forward.
Oh, that's interesting to know. Quitters, if you've tried 2, 3, 6 times and haven't completely quit the habit, don't give up. The average is 11 times, which is a very interesting stat. Sarah, what are the various techniques that are made available to the person trying to quit?
So I have to say, really, first of all, identifying and thinking about your past quit attempts. You know, what worked, what didn't work,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, there's no cookie cutter approach to this. We're so different. So thinking about past quit attempts and then trying to find, you know, what resources are available. Are you a person that, you know, needs to be in a group with other people? Do you need to have that, you know, face-to-face attention? Or can you do this through the phone, through counseling? So finding those resources. The next one I would say, honestly, would be nicotine replacement.
Mm-hmm.
Because as Dana said, you know, this is a difficult process. You know, it takes multiple quit attempts. So to have something that works on those quit cravings and, you know, really those withdrawal symptoms so you can focus on making those little changes along the way helps out a whole lot. And nicotine replacement, the patch, gum, or lozenge,
is always going to be safer than smoking cigarettes.
Right.
Or vaping in the case, too. So, yeah. You know, if you haven't tried nicotine replacement, give it a chance. See how it goes, you know. And if, you know, it works, let's keep it going. Another thing I say, too, before, like, someone's ready to commit to that date is have a practice date. Have a practice day where you try, you know, the patch, or you just try to go without smoking for one day and then assess at the end of the day. How'd this go? Well, you know, if it went well, let's keep it going to the next day. If it didn't, you know, let's figure out what we need to really make ourselves more comfortable through that. It's all trial and error. And when you have someone to help kind of guide you through it, like the local people or the counselors through 1-800-QUIT-NOW, it makes it a whole lot easier. You don't have to do this alone.
Oh, I love the idea of a practice day. Let's head to Corinth and talk to Forbes. Hi, Forbes. Go right ahead.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Marco the magician has a hypnosis program for this particular topic. What does she know about that?
Either of you, how about hypnosis? It might not be one of the practices you subscribe to, but do you know anything about how people have fared with hypnosis to quit?
I have, actually. I've worked with quite a few people that have incorporated it as another tool. You know, they haven't alone using hypnosis, but it's rethinking, retraining how we think. So if that's a tool that, you know, while it's not evidence-based and I can't hypnotize you in the office as much as I'd love, it's another tool to put in your belt. So by having regular hypnosis treatments, which is changing the way your self-talk is about smoking, is definitely beneficial. While there is no magic wand to tap and you're tobacco free, any tools that we can put in place to assist with the quit that makes it easier for us, yes. I mean, I've met many people that use acupuncture as well as getting the counseling and nicotine replacement.
Yeah.
It's one of the biggest things you can do for your health. So the more tools we incorporate, the better the outcomes.
Yeah. Dana, what are the logical arguments you present to a person trying to quit about why it would be a good thing for them to put away the smokes?
Yeah, I think, you know, all of those ideas of like telling people, oh, how this is so bad for you and it could cause all these issues. You know, we find that most people who are using tobacco, they already know all of those concerns, right? Like this isn't new information. This isn't new knowledge that people are completely unaware of, that smoking cigarettes is not going to be good for them or for their health. So I think we've had to really be creative in understanding that this is an addiction and that this is not something we can just throw information at or shame people into quitting. Like there's so much more involved and a lot of brain chemistry involved. And like Sarah said, you know, we really, any way we can retrain our brains and help each other kind of think through why we're using tobacco. And you know, for a lot of people, it is that mental health and that stress. You know, this is a stressful time, obviously, in the last 2 years has been a really challenging time for almost everyone. And I think understanding how stress plays a huge factor into tobacco use and into your addiction and really understanding how to kind of address that and how to look for new ways to manage stress that aren't, you know, turning to tobacco.
Sarah, no names, obviously, but can you share an example of someone you've partnered with who has quit?
Oh, my gosh. I have so many fabulous
16
stories.
Years.
I have a story of one gentleman that started saving all his cigarette money. He was putting it in a jar. And he actually went to put a down payment on his vehicle in cash. And they're like, oh, no, we take cashier's checks. Or, you know, you need a check. Because he took his smoking money to put down payment. I have people that are saving money that have never bought themselves winter coats or, you know, gone out for a fancy meal because that's a lot of money that you're taking away, $100 a week. So to be able to put that back towards themselves has just to see the joy in their faces or people that have never taken a vacation that have saved that money. But I have to say, as leading groups, one of my favorite things to see is that when people start the group, you know, they're usually not feeling well and their skin tone's a little more gray.
Mm-hmm.
If I could take a picture of them when they first come,
and then within the next few weeks to see, like, how the color returns to their face, how they're getting energy, even, like, how their eyes are, like, almost clearer and have a shine to them because they're getting oxygen to their body again.
Oh.
And just to see how good they're feeling after 2 weeks and looking with not having cigarettes or vaping in their daily life. Oh, so many good stories.
Yeah.
And there's also been, you know, I work in the hospital, so I've sat bedside to dozens of people, you know, who have passed away from smoking-related diseases. Mm-hmm. And to hear them say, you know, I wish I could have quit smoking. You know, what can I do to help other people?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just to see that side of it gives you real perspective, to see the beauty of quitting, but to see how it can affect you in life is, you know, a visual that sticks with you.
Dana, you mentioned this earlier. It's on a commercial that we're now airing, and it mentions that even if you don't quit the first time or the second time, you do learn new things each time you try to quit that can help you in successive attempts. I love this idea. So what kinds of things do people learn that help them later on?
I think a lot of people learn about their triggers, and I think a lot of, you know, people don't realize, like, oh, I thought I was smoking only at these certain times because that's just what I used to do. But then they kind of dive into, like, oh, like, whenever I'm having a stressful day, that's when I really reach for a cigarette or I really reach for my vape. So I think a lot of times people learn, hey, I don't have the coping skills I thought I had. These are clearly my triggers. Next time I'm ready to quit, I really want to figure out how to better address these triggers. I think people also kind of understand which of the nicotine replacement therapy really works for them. Some people really like the gum or lozenges. Some people really don't like those. Some people prefer the patch or some other type of nicotine replacement. So I think it's both physiological, like kind of how their physical body responds, but I think also there's ways of understanding just like mentally how they respond to certain situations. I think there's a lot that folks can learn from each quit attempt.
Sarah, I hate to get personal, but have you ever been a smoker?
I was during college. Trust me, this voice is not natural. yes, I was an art and psychology student, and we shared the same building with our nursing students. And believe it or not, in college, the nursing students were the majority of the people that were outside smoking. And I got sucked right into it and developed polyps on my vocal cords within the first year and had to have a minor surgery. So I learned quick. One would think that would cause you to quit right away, too. And it actually took a few quit attempts afterwards. And Dr. Charnock, you know, giving me a very stern conversation saying, hey, you know, I know you're still smoking. And had I not, I mean, everyone says I probably would sound like Marge Simpson today or Darth Vader had I not quit when I did.
Well, I think you have a lovely voice now, so you quit at the right time. Dana, why is this program one that the state is involved with? Why not let people quit on their own?
We know in Vermont that a lot of the premature deaths and a lot of the illness that we have in this state are caused by smoking-related illnesses. We know that this is a really a big priority for us as a state and to, you know, help other Vermonters. This is a program that's been in existence for over 10 years at this point, if not longer. This is a big deal for us as a state to say, hey, we care about all of you and your health and the health of our state. You know, we also address, in our larger program, we look at, you know, secondhand smoke and the prevention of youth from becoming smokers. So I think we as a state really know how important everyone's health is and everyone working together to support each other and to live healthier, happier lives.
Sarah, what effect did the pandemic have on smoking and quitting rates in Vermont?
Well, I can tell you a lot of the people I was working with, we will continue to work with. There was a lot of relapses, especially with my youth in vaping. The ones that I was working with consistently, a lot of them fell off, and stress and uncertainty was a huge piece, and not having, you know, those skills in place without the cigarettes they're vaping definitely had an impact. So personally, I'm seeing more people out there right now smoking and struggling to quit than right before COVID started.
Dana, you've both mentioned vaping, which I'm glad that's part of 802 Quits. Is vaping as addictive and dangerous as smoking traditional cigarettes?
Yes. And in fact, it can be more addictive because the nicotine concentration in vaping is significantly higher than in a cigarette. So actually, we do see vaping as just as dangerous as smoking cigarettes. And what is more startling is that for most of the new, you know, I wouldn't call them new smokers, but new tobacco users, our youth who are, you know, using these vapes at very young ages and in schools, which I think that's what really is one of the larger concerns is this vaping really leading to more tobacco use, especially in younger populations.
Mm. Sarah, what satisfaction or gratification do you get from seeing someone quit?
Well, I have to say, you know, the color of their skin and to see energy come back to them.
Mm-hmm.
Being in the small community, too, I have to be honest, like, I don't know why I just got choked up right there, is to have someone that yell down the aisle at the grocery store, like, 1 year tobacco-free, Sarah. And just to have that peace is so cool. It really is. Or, like, right now, I'm actually doing a PSA anti-vaping and substance abuse with a group of kids, and we're going over how dangerous vaping and tobacco is because they're going to be making their own videos for us to share with the community. And to see how when a kid gets it in their head, like, wow, you know, vaping is as dangerous, how do we let everyone know, you know, those are the victory moments when, you know, peer-to-peer they want to help each other and they want to spread the message. And using that youth voice to get the message out about how dangerous these products are and the impact it has on the community is so important. And I think we need to get more youth voices out there spreading that message.
All right. We're going to try to squeeze in a call. George, as quickly as you can, we've got George from Brookfield.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
Morning, yes. I was a chewer, and it's been a year and a half since I've chewed, but I think I'm hooked on the Nicorette lozenges. Seems like I can't, and I've cut them in half. You know, I was just using the 2 milligrams.
Yeah.
So I've cut them in two, and hopefully that I can wean back. But as I say, I can go a week or so or two without them and chewing gum, but it seems like I go back to the Nicorette.
All right, George. Sarah, when someone does have a replacement like the lozenges, how do you then get them off that?
Well, I'm going to start from saying congratulations.
Yeah.
This is a very difficult time to go tobacco-free, and I know a lot of people would chew because you're absorbing a lot of that nicotine struggle. So congratulations. You should be very proud of yourself. Lozenges always going to be safer than chew. And you know, being able to do smaller and smaller pieces is fantastic. But I have people that will take it out of their mouth when they're actually feeling better and, like, wrap it in a plastic bag and only use it for little amounts. But also being able to replace it with something else. Do you like cinnamon candy? Do you like chewing gum, you know, mints? And start incorporating one of those non-nicotine, you know, pieces into the mix. That might help. I don't want you to worry too much about the Nicorette gum or the nicotine lozenges because I've talked to many, many providers. And other than, you know, it costing, they all say it's much safer than using. So don't get on yourself too much, especially after a year and a half. You know, you're still in that gentle time. So be patient with yourself. You know, just keep the lozenge or the gum in your mouth until you start feeling better and, you know, take it out. And start incorporating other flavors in there. I find cinnamon being one of the strongest ones.
Yeah.
Just some dollar store cinnamon candy just to put in the mix, too.
Oh, you're such a good quit partner. Sarah Cosgrove, Dana Bourne, I want to thank you both for being on this morning. And listeners, to learn more about the program, you can visit 802quits.org. Thanks again, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, take care. We're going to go for a break and then come back to hear the amazing music of Dobe Ganore. And coming up today at 1, we've got Travels with Charlie Papillo. That's followed by The Getaway with Gregarious Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. In my constant quest to find out what's happening in our area, I stumbled upon the fact that our next guest had 4 shows scheduled in and around our area. And when I listened to her music, I was enthralled and reached out immediately to have her on the show. And I want to make sure that you know about her. We're still trying to get her. She's Grammy award-winning artist from Côte d'Ivoire, Dobe Ganore. And while we're waiting for her, I do want to play some of her music. And this is called Levez-toi. That is L'Evétoire by Dobe Gunore, who performed yesterday in Claremont, New Hampshire at the St. Gaudens Memorial. She then will be performing Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday in our area. Tuesday at Broad Street Park in Claremont, New Hampshire. Wednesday here at the Middlesex Bandstand, and then on Thursday at the Feast and Field Market in at Barnard's in Barnard. And we are anxiously trying to connect with Dobe Gunore so we can learn about her musical background. She's also a phenomenal dancer, and so seeing her live is a treat, both musically and then to see her dance. Friday, I was burning up email and texting with messages to friends that they need to listen to this music. Dobe Gunore is a Grammy-winning artist, an amazing dancer, and is in our area for three more performances. This is Vermont Viewpoint. She appeared yesterday at St. Gaudens Memorial and appears tonight or tomorrow night in Claremont, New Hampshire, and then in Vermont for two nights, Wednesday in Middlesex, Thursday in Barnard. And we're still, unfortunately, trying to connect with Dobe, but it's okay. I'd rather her music do the talking for you this morning. We heard before the break, L'Evétoire. Let's hear another song by Dobe Gunore. This is Ma Maison. It gives me great pleasure to play the music of Dobe Ganore for you this morning. She is from the Ivory Coast, won a Grammy in 2010, and is playing in the area yesterday at the St. Gaudens Memorial, and tonight or tomorrow night will be in Claremont, New Hampshire, and then two nights in Vermont, Wednesday at the Middlesex Bandstand, and then Thursday in Barnard. That's part of the Barn Arts down at Feast and Field Market in Barnard. So you'll have the opportunity to see her and probably hear her speak. Unfortunately, we've had a real problem connecting this morning, trying to get Dobe on the air with us, and I apologize for that. But in place of hearing her speak, you get to hear more of her music. And this next song is called Yakane, and it has such a beautiful message about women being independent. So let's hear Yakane from Dobe Ganore. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. You've been listening to the music of Dobe Ganore, and that was Yakane, and a beautiful song about the independence of women. She writes these very inspiring songs. We've heard Levé Toi, which is about how there's hope that it gets better tomorrow, and also Maison, which is about home and family. Now, Dobe Ganore will be performing. She's a beautiful singer and dancer, performing on Tuesday night, tomorrow night at Broad Street Park in Claremont, New Hampshire, and then Wednesday at the Middlesex Bandstand. I think that's at Camp Mead, and I believe it's at 6:30. And then Thursday at the Feast and Field Market at Barnard's in Barnard. And you can go to Dobeg Nore, which is D-O-B-E-T, Gnore, GNAHORE.com to learn all about that information. Incredible singer, musician, dancer, songwriter. And as I said, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in our area, you can go to Dobe Gnore for more details. Unfortunately, we were not able to connect with Dobe this morning. And it was a special treat, though, to hear her music. We're going to leave with one more after I finish the outro here. This is our Vermont Viewpoint, directed today by Lee Cattell and Stephen Tanzi. And listeners, of course, feel free to suggest guests by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint. Subscribe to them at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah is up next. I'll be back tomorrow, and we're going to discuss climate change with Roger Hill. And then we're going to head to the kingdom for a corn maze and an arts festival. And now one more beautiful song from Dobe Gnore. This is Mapu.
Asokondi ma pebla, asokondi mieni. Bose ade fene fene da. Bose ade fene fene la. Nataka tuishi pamoja, nataka tuishi milele na milele.